The following is a message from George Trujillo, a data strategist at DataStax. As a reminder, DataStax is the only financial sponsor of Data Mesh Radio and the Data Mesh Learning community at this time. I work with George, and I would highly recommend speaking with him. It's always a fun conversation.
One of the key value propositions of a data mesh is empowering lines of business to innovate with data. So it's been really exciting for me personally to see data mesh in practice and how it's maturing. This is a significant organizational transformation, so it must be well understood. Empowering developers, analysts, and data scientists with downstream data has been part of my personal data journey that reemphasized the importance of reducing complexity in real-time data ecosystems and the criticality of picking the right real-time data technology stack. I'm always open and welcome the opportunity to share experiences and ideas around executing a data mesh strategy. Feel free to email or connect with me on LinkedIn if you'd like to talk about real-time data ecosystems, data management strategies, or data mesh. The contact information can be found in the notes below. Thank you.
A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP and Field CDO at Starburst, and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading contributor to Trino, the open source project, and the Data Mesh for Dummies book that I co-wrote with Colleen Tarto and Andy Mott. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Brandon Bidell, Director of Product at Red Ventures. So some key takeaways or thoughts of my perspective of what I saw was Brandon's point of view. Number one, be willing to change your mind, especially based on new information. Be willing to measure and iterate. It's easy to get attached to tools or tech because they are cool. Don't. Stay objective. Number two, it's crucial to align on what problem or problems you are trying to solve and why before moving forward on vendor tool selection, no matter build versus buy. If it doesn't have a positive return on investment, why do the work? Number three, beware the sunk cost fallacy. It's easy to not want to shut something down that you've spent a lot on, but don't throw good money after bad. Number four, when requirement gathering or negotiating, have a maniacal focus on asking, what does this drive for the business? You can quickly sort the nice to haves from the needs, and you can have an open and honest conversation about cost benefit of each aspect of a request. Number five, when thinking about maximizing value, there is always one constraint that is the bottleneck. You can optimize other things, but they won't drive the value. Find and fix the value bottleneck. Number six, a simple two axes framework when thinking about use cases and requirements is value versus complexity. Obviously, look for high value, low complexity first. Number seven, be open and honest in discussions around expected costs of work and tools, which can be considered part of the complexity. The data consumers understand the value and can weigh the return on investment. Number eight, it's very important to understand data consumers' incentives so you can collaboratively figure out what is best for all parties. Number nine, look to create in the open a decision journal relative to build versus buy, you know, vendor selection kind of decisions. It will create an open environment and get your thoughts better organized. Number 10, that decision journal will make it easier politically to say you have new information and should consider a change. And you can better measure against if your assumptions were right or, you know, when it's time to reevaluate if a tool or solution is still working for you. Number 11, it's very crucial to look at potential major success of a tool selection. What happens if our use is 10x or 100x our initial expectation? That can lead to really poor unit economics in the future for certain selections, so it shouldn't be overlooked. Number 12, it's easy to over-innovate. Think of having a certain number of innovation tokens. The cost of change is real and also hits people's patience. Look to see if existing tooling or capabilities support most of your use case first before asking and evaluating something new. Number 13, total cost of ownership, not just, you know, initial purchase price, is crucial. How much of your team's time will be spent managing and maintaining the tool? Look especially at skills, governance controls, and the ability to measure if you are successful. Number 14, perfect is the enemy of good in choosing tools. Use a well-defined process to avoid really bad decisions, but spending time to find the absolute best solution when any one of like six choices will do just fine is rarely worth it. Number 15, having your reasoning and process written down and in the open drives trust. Trust towards the initial decision and trust for when it's time to reevaluate a tool, right? It also makes it easier to spot if something relative to your initial assumptions has changed. Number 16, seek out those who might be the most against your decision. Take the time to understand their pain points and concerns. Try to incorporate their concerns and align their incentives if possible. Number 17, when adding a new tool or serving a new use case, focus on how you will measure if you are successful now and in the future. It doesn't have to be perfect, but otherwise you don't know how well you are doing and will miss out on, you know, a great learning experience to do better in the future. Number 18, when you select a vendor, there is a logical time to reevaluate your choice and if it's going if the right thing going forward, you know, when the contract renewal is coming up. And there are easily defined economics in play, right? You should do the same thing for anything you've built. Set an artificial time to reevaluate. Don't wait for things to go bad before you say, is this going to go bad? Is this going bad? Number 19, use the anti-corruption concept from microservices in data. You can avoid a lot of data integration costs and you are more easily able to rip things out of your platform. But it's okay to leverage proprietary solutions too in data mesh. It doesn't have to all be open source or homegrown or whatever. Just be cognizant that, you know, using proprietary things may become an issue in the future. Finally, number 20, involve the data consumers early in the process around serving their use case. And it helps for them to have skin in the game so they are focused on driving to the most business efficient outcome. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Very, very excited for today's episode here. I've got Brandon Beidle, who is the Director of Product at Red Ventures. And I reached out to Brandon specifically because he had been on an episode of the Data Engineering Podcast and was talking a lot about some really interesting concepts around treating your platform as a product, right? And I'm not even sure if you used that exact phrase, but it really was, everything was, this is a living, breathing thing. Right. And how do you think about actually building this out? So we're going to talk about some vendor selection stuff, you know, build versus buy. And we're going to talk about like how things obviously change over time. So what assumptions you had, they might have been justified historically, but like your assumptions and your priorities are changing. So how do you think about that? His way of looking at tool stewardship, I think, is really important as well, that we don't just get something into production, that we have to keep it healthy and maintained and all of that, and that we keep that kind of knowledge flowing as well as to other people how to use that. And just kind of why are we seeing so much entropy, especially more recently in the data space, and how can we deal with that? What does it mean? So very excited, because I think this is really important for a lot of you people out there that are looking at how do we build the initial data platform, but not set ourselves up for too much tech debt. So with that as some background to the conversation, Brandon, if you don't mind giving people a bit of a introduction to yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation at hand.
Certainly. Thanks for having me, Scott. My name is Brandon Beidle. Like you said, I'm a director of product at Red Ventures. Within Red Ventures, I work on our marketing agency line of business. Specifically, my role is focused on building, maintaining, and curating the tools that we used for our data operations and our marketing operations. So anything from ingest to optimization to reporting, if it touches data and it worked, that's where I focus my time.
Awesome. Yeah. And I think it's especially in the kind of marketing data space, that space moves so quickly around every tool and everything moving around. So I think a good place to start, we've had a couple of people talking on about this, but I love to get multiple perspectives on this about how do you think when you're going into vendor selection and you start to think about maybe even are you going out there and saying, okay, we need somebody to cover this feature, or how do you start that process? And then how do you think about build versus buy and how you get kind of from A to B? Because it presumably isn't somebody saying, we need to buy, you know, XYZ tool. It's okay, why? Like, how do you think about doing that in an appropriate way instead of the let's go splash some cash on some interesting tools?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. We really try to take an approach of agreeing on what job needs to be done. I really like that kind of mentality of, you know, it's not about buying a tool. It's not about building, you know, getting new features. It's about solving a specific problem. And so we really, as a group, sit down in really cross-functional teams, you know, include the business, include engineering, include data science, include legal, include privacy, include procurement. Like those groups of people, bring them together early on to understand what problem are we trying to solve. You know, some groups might be more concerned about different parts of the problem more than others. But ultimately, you know, really having a common understanding, and for us, you know, having that common understanding in writing. So before even we talk about a single vendor, you know, what is the problem we're trying to solve? Who's the customer solving it for? Being very explicit about what is the scope of the thing we're trying to solve, and then we start thinking about what vendors provide services or what tools we could build to even solve that. And that's where we lay out the options of multiple vendors, even against the build option or the extended open source project. Like those are all options on the table when we come across these sort of problem areas.
And when you think about that, how do you prevent yourself from going down the too many point solution problem, right? When you think about what challenge are we trying to solve? Are we just solving for this one challenge versus, hey, this is a repeated pattern, or we see this in multiple different ways. Let's try and pop up to even an even higher level than this specific challenge about like, hey, we don't want to have, you know, 15 different platforms internally versus we want to have kind of that cohesiveness. So when it's like, is it just that you're focused on a very specific challenge, or are you focused on kind of that and how does it play into the bigger group, the bigger set of challenges?
I think maybe we're just benefiting from kind of a maniacal focus on the question of like, what business impact does this decision have? What specific, like, what is this going to drive for our business? And very often, if we look at, you know, features that are on that wish list and they don't clearly drive value for the business, those are things that get deprioritized or put somewhere else, or kind of set to the side. So really what I would say is, rather than, you know, everybody can have that 100 item Christmas list, like pick two or three, you know, pick what are the most important things you need to have that are going to drive, because ultimately we are running a business. We have objectives we are trying to meet. Going down to feature 9 or 10 on a list isn't necessarily going to drive the impact that the first two or three that we really think are important should. So there's not like an arbitrary limit. It's more of a heuristic of, is this important enough to drive business value? If so, it's part of the list. It's part of what we're looking for. If not, it's kind of an addendum, nice to have sort of, list of features that we might use for comparison of vendors across space.
And do you see having a lot of, when you're thinking about that, like, what are we actually trying to solve, that there is a lot of kind of matching from different use case to different use case, where you start to see the same patterns and you go, okay, we've solved this before, we already have this, or hey, what you're trying to do, yes, you know, feature number or request number 7 could add additional value, but how do you think, but it's not worth the juice isn't worth the squeeze. How do you think about having that conversation? Because data consumers traditionally haven't been okay with they're like, I want to drop my requirements list on you and disappear, versus I want to partner with you. Like, how did you get to having those conversations, those deeper conversations about partnering with them?
I think it really comes down to having them involved early on in the process. Because in a lot of the times, at least in our organization, those business folks are actually the economic buyers on our side. They're the ones who are going to be signing these contracts with vendors if we go down that path, or that our engineering time is going to be put on their P&L. So really, when we come down to this question of trade-offs of feature sets and costs, we really try to have a frank conversation of, we can do these first three with cost X, but if we want these next three, it's 2X or 3X. And even if it's not an exact number of this is the value of these features, having that kind of broad conversation of saying, we think this is twice the amount of effort and is only going to be 20% of the value, we can do it, you know, then maybe it's a question, do we do it iteratively? Do we look at it in 6 months? Do we look at it in a year? There's multiple ways to negotiate around those things. And I think I've come to observe, at least in my career, that if you deliver two or three really valuable things to a consumer, they're going to forgive you some grace on the fifth and sixth and seventh requests. So I'm not too worried about those scenarios. It's more like showing value and helping understand the trade-offs in kind of a collaborative way, which I think really comes down to knowing your organization and knowing everyone's incentives. Not just your incentives internally, but the incentives of the vendors themselves. All of these things, you want to work together when your incentives are aligned, and there are going to be times when those incentives aren't aligned, and you're really trying to figure out how you allocate resources in a way that is the most appropriate allocation of resources in terms of like your responsibility, your organization. Because ultimately, you have limited resources. You want to use them as effectively as you can to drive whatever mission your organization has. And it's not always going to be not everyone's going to agree with that outcome, but you need to kind of negotiate to those terms.
Well, and I think You've hit on a phrase that I've been, maybe combination of two things that you were saying there. You've hit on a phrase I've been using more of, collaborative negotiation, because it is the, like, let's talk about what is the cost of doing that. And then you can tell me the benefit. And so if I say, hey, that's 80% of the, or that's 50% of the cost, that's 50% of the time, or it's going to push this out by 2 months instead of 2 weeks, like, is that what you want? And they're like, well, that's 90% of the value. It's like, okay, then yes, that is what you want. Versus, yeah. Okay, is that a nice to have? Or what are you trying to achieve with that, right? I have this problem a lot where I suggest people like one or two potential ways of achieving an outcome. I say, here's the outcome. I only want to focus on getting the outcome. Here are two or three potential ways. And people lock into those ways instead of that conversation of like, well, you're the expert on getting to the outcome, right? I'm the expert on giving you the context of what I need. You're the expert on delivering a solution to meet that. Like, let's exchange as much context as possible. But if you have a better way, do it the better way. Like, this is a potential way, but is that valid? Is that useful? And I think a lot of people aren't having those conversations. Did you find when you came in that that was kind of already the way people were working, or have you iterated with the organization to be like that?
I think it's been an iteration to get there. I, you know, based on some outside sources, and I think it's important to not make these sorts of, you know, cost benefit trade-offs overly complex or to give a sense of false precision. I think really I try to communicate this in those conversations really on two axes, complexity and value. And typically in those scenarios, I tend to observe that engineering teams tend to understand the complexity of things. They tend to understand the complexity of how difficult it will be to integrate with this API and set up a new account for a platform and what the mechanics of doing, you know, the thing will be. Whereas on the business side, they have more of a sense of value. If you tell them, here's a specific capability we will give you, what do you think it would you allow you to achieve? You know, for us marketing, it's very much the actions we take are based on expected lift to marketing performance. So for that, it's a relative equation. Oh, I think I'll have an X percent lift to my spend on this channel. The spend on this channel per year is X million per year, Y million per year. Therefore, I can say the benefit of this feature is somewhere between A and B dollars. So you can do kind of back of the math envelope on both sides. And then I find that putting them in kind of simple user story terms, we're going to achieve, you know, user can perform X task. It is a low complexity task with a high expected value. Great. That's where you want to start. Low complexity, high value. That's low hanging fruit. Let's do that first. When you get into the high complexity, high value tasks, that's kind of almost that's also a good space to work in. But the thing you want to avoid are those high complexity, low value tasks. So try not to be excessively precise, because these are all like estimates based on current belief. And as you learn more, your beliefs will change, both on the business side and on the engineering side, kind of estimating that complexity. But by keeping it in those terms, I think we've been able to navigate those conversations relatively effectively. There's always room to improve, but that's kind of the way we break this down, just like this 2x2 matrix of complexity and value. And where do we think this stuff falls on?
Yeah, I like that because it is that simplified thing of like everybody can kind of understand that. Like you said, the engineering team may not know exactly how to measure value, but they get the concept of value and they understand how to measure their complexity of doing this, and the business understands the value. And so you can put certain rough terms around it and go, okay, you know, between these four use cases, let's rank them. Like let's look at how complex or anything everything is. One thing you talked about in the interview with Tobias was about your documentation process around your justification for a lot of these decisions. Could you give people a little bit of background on that? And then we can talk about kind of what you've learned from doing that and maybe what you'd recommend other people to start to do or how to start to implement this if they haven't been, because, you know, it can be one of those, well, we haven't been doing it, so when can we start and all of that?
Yeah. So maybe the idea is definitely borrowed from other areas, but it might be floated around as like the idea of a decision journal. But really what I've come to find is that, writing down the decision-making process, writing down the criteria we're looking for, especially as the organization becomes larger and larger, helps people come along on the journey as needed. Because sometimes it's, 2 months into some process, somebody new joins the organization, they want to know what's going on, and there's kind of a consolidated place they can all go and see, what decision are we pursuing and why. But to the question, like we tend to break it down in a few categories. One, which is what capabilities are we trying to solve for? That is, again, this like feature list that we talked about there. What problem are we trying to solve? For whom? What are they trying to achieve? What sort of value are they going to get out of it? Once we agree on that, then we start to look at the alternatives themselves. Questions about like, how viable is this solution? Is it viable in the long term, in the short term? What's the total cost of ownership? I think this is a really undervalued, underappreciated thought is, even if we can build it ourselves, like there is cost associated with it, maintaining those. What are those costs likely to do over time, either with a vendor solution or with a homegrown solution? Knowing what the alternatives are, being very explicit that there are multiple vendors in a space. They do very similar thing. They might do very similar things. There are open source tools that are very similar things. Being cognizant of those options is also something we try to do very explicitly. Another thing we really make sure that is part of this process is identifying failure conditions. What would go wrong? What if these things happened, what would go wrong? What are the most likely things to go wrong? And then as an organization, we can think about how to mitigate those things. Think about skills, training, in order to like make this solution successful. What skills do we need to have in the organization? How do we, and I think this resonates a lot with what I've heard on your program this far, is a lot about making sure that consumers of products and people that are in those domains have the skills to leverage what they've been given and not just like throwing it over the fence and saying good luck. Because there might be solutions out there that you just don't have the skills to use as an organization. And so maybe it might be cool and it might solve the problem, but you're going to need a big, big push to get the skills where you need. Other things we think about, security and privacy, because we want to be cognizant of what requirements we have. And especially once you start talking about vendors and handling external data, we need to make sure that they're meeting our expectations for our clients' privacy and the privacy of the consumers that we're reaching out to. And then I think the last one, which is another kind of mental exercise, is thinking about, let's say you're right. Let's say you make the perfect decision. And all of a sudden your usage of this product you've brought on scales 10x or 100x or 1000x. What changes in your decision-making process or changes in reality? Does that mean you have to scale training 1000x? Does that mean you have, your cost structure has completely gone out of whack because of the terms you negotiated with your vendor? Does that mean your team needs to scale to that level? Like if not only what would happen if things went wrong, but what happens if things go right? How would you know, how would things change and how would you have to adapt if the thing you brought on is highly successful and well adopted and just for a voracious success for your organization? So that's the sort of, we have a list of questions kind of in those areas under each opportunity. And then we take the time to really vet all those things out. Maybe not necessarily like digging deep into each vendor yet, but just like at a high level, what we think those things are. And then once we have those sorts of high level questions answered, then we'll actually start to have vendor conversations. We've thought about the problem. We've thought about the space. We thought about what would go well if it works. We would thought about how it would fail if things went wrong. We have now informed ourselves, informed our opinions without what I think is a little bit dangerous of just absorbing the vendor speak. I think there's a little bit of a marketing buzz that happens when you're looking at tools in the space where they're trying to frame themselves in such a way to make you think that there's one problem when you really have another, or trying to carve out their own carve out their own piece of the market so that way you don't think they have competition. So I think it's really, really important that you are defining the problem, not the vendor. And that's why we really try to go through this process of figuring out what you're trying to solve and then think about all of the aspects of this problem before you go too deep. Now, I say all of that, but that's because I'm at a relatively large organization. A smaller organization, maybe that's only like two or three questions. Maybe it's like, what problem are we trying to solve? What are the potential vendors? And failure conditions, what could go wrong? It doesn't have to be big and complex, but I found that by having it in writing, by having it in the open air, that's, I think, the more important. It's not just in writing for me to see, but, let everyone see it, let the organization come to it later. Maybe they come back to it in a year whenever we come up for contract renewals, and we want to understand why we made the decision and what assumptions have changed. But in writing, in the open, for the whole organization to see, so that way they can follow along and really kind of be on that journey of deciding what to do with you.
And when you're on that journey, when you're on that process of making a decision, if some of your assumptions were wrong and you find them they're wrong, have you found that because you were open with your communication that people aren't holding it against you as much? Because I think that's a real worry, right? That of this is a big worry of anybody within data, of getting anything wrong, right? Everything has to be right, because that's the whole sense of how we think about data. And data isn't binary. It's not a one or a zero. I think that might be the data, not the actual information, right? But, is it a one or a zero? Well, what does a one or a zero even mean in this context? I think that's where we need to move away kind of from that binary thinking. But have you found that if you've had to make a change, or have you found that this gives you more kind of backward leaning, looking empathy, so that you can say, hey, we did the best, they did the best with what they knew and what they thought? Or has it made it so that you can better assess your historical things? I'm just trying to think about, because I think this works well, right? I think in theory, this works well, but I think there's a lot of people who are going to be concerned about trying to pick this up. So what do you think that it's been having? Maybe this has been the way it's been for you every time and all throughout your career, but I'm assuming most places it isn't like this. It isn't in the open. It isn't like that. So trying to get people okay with it and trying to, what have you learned from doing this that you don't think you would have learned in any other way? Or how can people feel comfortable heading down this journey?
I think first and foremost, I try to think about this as not as making the right decision, but as avoiding the wrong decision. It's almost a risk mitigation sort of mental exercise. If there are 10 vendors in a space, maybe six of them will do a well enough job and solve our problem. Finding the one that's eking out 5% more value, the marginal cost of running six trials and figuring out which one's the perfect one, that doesn't necessarily make sense for every problem. So I think of it less as trying to figure out which of the 10 options is going to be the perfect one, but instead, which of the 10 options would have been a horrible decision and something we want to avoid. That's just kind of how I frame this more generally. But I feel like the thing that I have learned over my career is this kind of open communication in writing, that logic can be followed, that it can be found later. It's something that I have been in organizations where technology decisions were made in private and they're hard to follow, after the fact. You're trying to understand why was it made, what assumptions were there. And that's honestly a difficult position for someone who's taking on tools to follow, because maybe they want to, you know, make a change. But if they don't understand the reasoning for it, they might not see the pitfalls that would have befallen them if they had taken the other path. So, there's certainly, I agree that there are, depending on the organization, there can be almost a disincentive to say, oh, I have learned new information and I want to make a new decision. But I think when framed as, hey, we learned something, we have new information, we have a new belief about the world, maybe there's a new paradigm we want to adopt, or, you know, the skills in the marketplace have changed and we're finding that we have the talent to do this other thing and we think it's going to be more valuable. I think good leaders at any level of any organization are going to be able to recognize that they don't use the term Bayesian, but they are Bayesian. They get new information, they make a new decision. And I think I've been the benefit of working now in organizations that see that. They have the information, they've seen we've updated our belief, and then we're willing to make a new decision over time. We've changed out vendors. We've changed technology paradigms. We've adopted some open source tools that the rest of the organization wasn't willing to adopt yet. Like we've made major changes in our tech stack against the strongly held beliefs of other folks in the organization. But by doing so in the open and expressing our logic and expressing the constraints of what we're willing to do, you know, we're running a trial and this is the constraint of the trial. It's only going to run for X long. And at X time, we will decide that the trial was a success or a failure by these criteria. And if it's a failure, this is what we're going to do. We're going to turn all the stuff off, get rid of it, and go back to the old way. So again, a long-winded way of saying, you know, keeping things out in the open, being willing to admit that we have new information, we should change our belief. I have had success with that. I recognize not every organization is necessarily going to be as receptive to that, but that's worked for me.
Yeah. Well, and I think one thing even about there, the logic of the past choices, you also see a little bit of the politics of the past choices as well. So you can avoid landmines about if that's out in the open, then people being like, oh, this person was really, really in favor of this. Like, let's go talk to them about, is this still working? And that you can have that and that you're not kind of, you know, cutting out their their favorite tool or whatever from the platform. And then it's going to lead to a fight versus like, hey, like this, here's what we're looking at. I don't know that this is still fitting with what we need to do. And you can have a little bit more open conversation. I think there's people that are worried about open communication, putting a target on their back. And I think maybe you just kind of have to deal with that a little bit of risk to get to where you need to go. But I haven't mentioned it super, super publicly, but I'll probably do that in the nearest future around, I think every leader should have an open journal. Every data mesh implementation leader should have an open journal, because we're all learning new things all the time, right? Like this podcast is kind of my open journal about what I'm learning. I think if you listen to thoughts that I had at the start, which was only, you know, 10 months ago or whatever, I've changed the way I think about a lot of this. And I think that's helpful. But I think people are kind of worried about that. Am I opening myself up for it?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point around kind of seeking out those people who you might expect to be detractors and really understanding why. You know, if you are bringing a new idea in to organization or a new decision, you are a salesman. Like, let's not cut, you know, mince words. Like, you are selling an idea. You are trying to find ways to persuade people to come to your side. And finding those people who are likely to be your detractors, regardless of their role in the organization and their level, is only going to help you. Because let's say you go and have an honest conversation and you learn some information that's actually going to change your belief, or you come to understand their incentives more and how to, you know, what evidence do they need to change their mind, I think is a great question to ask when you're running against those detractors. Is, someone has made this decision, you'd like to make a new one, and you go to them and say, what would it take to change your mind? What evidence would you need? Because I think if then presented with those evidence and they, fail to change their mind, well, then they weren't negotiating in good faith. And then you have a different problem on your hand. You have a very political problem on your hand. So I think finding ways to work with those people to understand how they are either for or against an idea, and ultimately building up to that case of what evidence do we need to collect to really persuade either them to change their mind or you to change your mind. Because that might actually be a reasonable outcome is you've decided, I want to go down this path of data mesh, for instance. I want to really adopt these practices. But if I go to a leadership who's been very adamantly against it, and I go to them and they have a conversation where they make some really compelling points based on like where our organization is and the technical debt associated with it and like where they think business changes are going to be occurring, maybe they make a really compelling case that like the time isn't right, and then I can digest that, make a new decision, and kind of move on from there. So I would not run away from the people who you might disagree with. I think embracing that is actually going to help make your decisions in a longer run more effective and stickier, regardless of how they or where it ends up.
You're getting more context. So you may change your decision simply based on that context rather than you're going out and only trying to sell. Right? Like if you're just trying to convince everybody to come to your way of thinking instead of an actual exchange, then you're also negotiating in bad faith, right? So exactly right. What you're talking about of, okay, I thought that what we were trying to solve was X, but really from this conversation, X isn't that important. Y is much more important. And so, it's like time to market versus data quality versus, scalability or whatever. Those questions, it's not even you get to pick two. It's often you get to pick one. And if somebody just keeps saying time to market every single time, then you need to kind of dig into why they're so interested in time to market. And maybe you can get something in their hands that's good enough in beta form for them to make a few decisions to move forward on some things while you're getting to something that's actually productionizable, right? Like that it's, you can do that. So, I liked a lot of you're very kind of even keeled about this. You're very pragmatic about your approach. I think that's very helpful. When you are seeing these, like what are the signals that you're watching for, or what are the signals maybe that you see that it's time to reevaluate? Not even necessarily we have to make a change, but like. And kind of what you talked about as well of is there a return on doing this, right? And so, yes, we could make the switch from, ABC to, DEF, but those two, like I'm going to get a 5% benefit to what I'm doing of value, but it's going to cost a lot or it's going to defocus us or whatever. Like, how do you start that process of finding when it's time to reevaluate?
Well, I think this is a, begin with the end in mind sort of problem is, when you're bringing something on, a new, bringing on a new paradigm, bringing on a new project, really setting up, how are you going to measure success and having that frank conversation? Measuring success could just be measured by a survey sent out to staff. If you're talking about like an enablement tool, like maybe we're going to send out surveys on a quarterly basis to the team that we're trying to support. And ultimately our goal is customer satisfaction. If we don't see those numbers moving, well, then something's not working, 2-3 data points. It doesn't necessarily have to be a numeric automated metric, but really just agreeing up front is like, go back to that original, problem statement. What problem are we trying to solve? And then how do we measure it? What are those key outcomes? If we don't see those key outcomes changing, there is some element of our hypothesis is not working. So, there are kind of logical off ramps for a lot of these decisions. I think the one benefit of going with a vendor solution is they provide that logical off-ramp in contract expiration. So let's say you buy a tool, you get it for a year, and then 9 months later, you're like, are we really getting value out of this? Is this really worth however many thousands of dollars we spend a year? And then if you're not thinking about that value, if you haven't explicitly stated it, you wouldn't necessarily be able to have that like thoughtful conversation of, oh yes, we said it was going to solve problem X and it was going to drive Y value. And here's the incremental effect we can see over here in this system. And yes, we observed, we got value, we're willing to proceed. Versus if you don't think about that and you just kind of hum along and say, yes, we plugged in this tool into our system and we're just gonna renew because we said we were going to do it and we have to do it. But like, where's your evidence? Where's your evidence that it succeeded? So having those contractual kind of mile markers, I think is actually like a really good time to sit down and think about, is this tool really solving the problem we set out to solve? Is it doing so in a way that we can measure and observe? And is it doing at a economic value point that makes sense for us as an organization? Because back to the, there might be 10 tools in the marketplace, 6 of them would be good enough. Well, maybe one of the other 6 would actually be a better choice for us economically because of where we are as a business. And again, that's fine to make a different decision, but you need to have that conversation to reevaluate at those certain points. Internal projects, I think kind of in a similar fashion, we try to set time parameters of we're running a trial for X months, and at which point we will have an internal review and observe outputs and say this project was, you know, it can be a successful project from a learning experience, but it can still be a failure in terms of economic value, which it's fine. Again, there's no problem with like us building something, seeing that we could, but finding that it actually didn't have the outcome we needed. So like, well, then let's turn off the code, turn off the infrastructure and like move on to the next thing. But really that putting a time constraint on it, I think is the artificial time constraint is really kind of how we sort of force those conversations.
Yeah. I like that forcing function. I like the, you peppered it in there a couple of times of the economic, right? It's not just the technical decision. It's the economic decision as to, and one thing that I've talked about is with cloud, especially with data mesh, what we're trying to get to is a place where we can make more bets, right? Easier, and we can measure if our bets are paying off and that there are lower stakes that we can put up. And we can see, do we think that it's going to drive the value? And so we have a faster way to shut things off. But making bets, by the actual definition of betting, is that you don't know that it's a for sure positive net economic outcome. And so it's okay when that happens, right? It's not the end of the world versus historically, if you've gotten something really wrong with data, if something didn't work out, you had this big time investment, you had this big ramp up, you know, all of these things, you know, you bought a bunch of, you know, actual physical servers and things like that. We're not in that world anymore, but we're still treating it like we're in that world and moving beyond that is really important.
It is the sunk cost fallacy by definition. The idea that we have spent a bunch of time and we want to continue throwing money at, you know, throw good money after bad. That is something I really appreciate from my Econ 101 courses in college, being like, yes, there is a reason you, like, once the money is spent, it is spent. Once the code has been written, it's been written. Like, you cannot get that time back. So don't try to. If it's a bad idea, you have evidence to think it's a bad idea, stop pursuing it. Do something else. There is a limited amount of energy and time and resources. Go do something else. Go work on a different problem.
Yeah, I think that's a really important message that we need for all of engineering, but especially around data, because it has been that there's a positive return instead of there's a positive return on investment, right? And so, you know, okay, we started doing this thing. It's okay to shut it down, right? And set yourself up where you can where you're not putting all your marbles in one basket, right? You talked about that high value, high complexity. If your team isn't capable right now of delivering on high complexity things, don't go for the high complexity right now, because your risk reward on that high complexity, high value, it's going to be really, really challenging to get there. Not saying don't ever, you know, kind of shoot for things, but also like, to thine own self be true, right? Like know where your capabilities are, and can we actually achieve this? And can we achieve it in the reasonable time period, right? Like, it's not just this will drive, if this thing is going to, we're going to invest $100,000 and it's going to result in $1 million of revenue a year, but it's going to cost us, you know, $100,000 this year. And in 15 years, it's going to start resulting in $1 million a year. Do we really think that that's actually the case? And do we think that that's really worth it? I know those numbers probably aren't exact, but if it's like $100,000 of revenue a year, and it's going to take you forever to get there, is it really worth it?
Yeah, it's, yeah, that's very much a payback period economic thinking. Like, you're taking on a project, how many years, if you're going to build this homegrown system to replace vendor X, how many years will you have to have that system up and running before it makes economic sense to switch away from that vendor? You know, those sorts of conversations are like, need to be part of when we want to take on these projects, or when we want to turn something off. Like, we don't run charities. Well, maybe some people do that are listening, but like, even charities still have expenses, and like, there's like considerations around costs. And like, if we want to function in a business as a part of that business, we have to have those economic considerations in mind.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really something that a lot of people, I wish more economics were taught I think there needs to be more philosophy and ethics and economics taught when it comes to anything data related. One thing you talked about a little bit earlier was this, which you're kind of, I think we've touched on a lot, which was the concept of tool stewardship, right? Like, we've talked about a lot of these things of, you know, what you just said there of, we could build this homegrown, but the vendor is going to have the feature, and we can get the feature that we want, you know, in week six, but the vendor, if we partner with them, they're going to have it in month six. So is there really that value to us getting there that much quicker? And are we really willing to continue to develop and support and maintain and all of these, especially with how much everything changes in data right now? Like, how do you communicate that internally? It sounds like your team understands this stuff now, but you know, when you were first kind of starting to communicate that, if somebody wanted to talk through that decisioning and be like, hey, this is our total cost of ownership. It's not just the initial push. We're not just trying to get something, you know, the ball moving. We're trying to get it moving and keep it moving. So how do you think about that conversation, especially if you're in the shoes of a lot of people out there who aren't in your current situation? Like, how would you recommend that they go about that conversation?
Yeah. So the way we tend to break this down, and again, it's not, certainly not a one size fits all, is really around kind of skills. You know, what skills do people need to really leverage this tool set? Because a tool on its own might not be useful. You know, a hammer sitting on the shelf does not, you know, put in a nail. So we need to make sure that the people, folks that are going to use these tools, have the skills to do so. We think about, and part of that total cost of ownership, also controls and governance. I think those terms might be a little overloaded, but when I say controls and governance, I just say, what processes are around those tools? What best practices do you have? You know, developing those, maintaining those, communicating those, I think is also important, and something we focus on, and my product team focuses on. And the last one we think about in terms of stewardship is back to a little earlier in our conversation. We talked about knowing if a decision was successful, setting up those metrics and monitoring. How are we going to measure the success of this tool? And so this skills, controls, and governance metrics and monitoring, I think working with a vendor, you can partner with them to solve those problems. You know, the skills, their incentives are for your product to be the use of the product to be successful. They are willing to help train. They are willing to help. You know, a good SaaS provider is going to want to make sure that you get used out of the tool. So if you lay out in very specific detail who you want to know, what you want them to know, you should be able to either have them provide you resources, provide training, or something you have to build internally. We've seen all variants of that. And that kind of gets wrapped into this total cost of ownership idea. Controls and governance, same sort of paradigm. It's there's a tool, but there's like a very specific way your company wants to use the tool. So you might make a very specific decision that you want to use a template for a code template or a monitor, an alert template or some sort of message template. You know, maybe it's not built into the product, but it's something you want to convey. And then along with that is you have to go in and audit and enforce and make sure that you're actually and train on those best practices. So there's a cost of ownership there. Like if you're going to bring on this tool, you know, and have governance and have controls, you either have to automate those controls or you have to have some element of people going in and making sure that the tools are getting used the way you expect. And if they're not, understand why. Oh, because the tool doesn't really solve the problem that way. Or here's this other use case we hadn't thought about. Like just because someone's not adhering to some process that you set up at the beginning doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means you didn't understand something in its entirety, or perhaps the end user didn't quite understand what your intent was, or didn't have the skills to understand how to solve the problem. And then the metrics and monitoring, I think, is again another thing we want to spend time on, is because we want to know if we made a good bet. We want to know if we're getting the value out of this thing. So those three things: skills, controls and governance, metrics and monitoring, kind of lumped under things we need to be doing when we buy a tool, or even when we build a tool. Because I still think that's important. You don't just like throw software out there and not listen to your customer, or not listen or not train them on it, or not track how your software is being used. I think that these elements get baked in. Like the costs of building a tool are very clear. It's labor costs and of the engineering time, and it's infrastructure costs of maintaining it. But these other things layered on top to like wrap around these tools, I think is also an important part to think about. And it could be like, again, I'm at a large organization, so we have maybe a few more folks that we have product managers really wrapped around these services. But it could be like the engineering lead could be thinking about, how do I train my end users? How do I make sure that people are going through the flow in the way I need? How do I make sure that, you know, the pages are getting used in the right way? Like I worry less about the title of the person who does it and more that it gets done, because you don't just want to throw a tool into someone's hand and assume they're going to use it or they're going to use it effectively.
So one thing that I was not expecting when I started asking a lot of these questions was, a lot of what you're talking about is just intentionality around reviewing things versus you're waiting for the signals. So it's almost like instead of the alert monitoring, you're doing more observability, right? You're doing observability into how is my data platform, my tooling selection, all of that doing, because you're going in and saying, hey, I'm going to reevaluate this at a certain time, right? You talked about that with the contract. It's kind of an artificial reason to start to look at that, but you talked about that as well with the internal tooling and things. And I think a lot of what you're talking about is just being very intentional about, this is a living, breathing ecosystem around data. We have seen just a massive increase in, you know, I'm sure you've seen the Matt Turk mad landscape, right? Where it's the thing, you know, Zhmak refers to it as the Cambrian explosion. and there's, you know, 1,000 tools or technologies on this thing. And it's literally, I think it is actually literally 1,000 on there. You have to scroll in like 9 times to be able to differentiate anything. So how do you think about kind of all of the entropy that we've seen, but kind of focusing on doing the day-to-day work? A lot of what it seems like you're saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's like, just have intentionality, focus on kind of what matters rather than a lot of the noise, and be okay that you're not using necessarily all the coolest things, but also those cool things, you if they're going to deliver on what you want to do, it's okay to buy into to that as well. Like, actually think about what you're trying to do and not do too much work to try and, you know, perfect being the enemy of good and all of that stuff. It's kind of what it sounds like. But, you know, I guess there's a lot of people out there that are really struggling with how fast things change and how fast things, it seems like this thing is a thing of yesteryear. And how do you think about that? How would you talk to somebody that's coming to you and saying, you know, Brandon, I want you to be my therapist. How do I deal with this?
Yeah. I always go, I try not to deal in absolutes. I tend to go back to, this idea, the theory of constraint. In any system, there is only ever one bottleneck, one place that is constraining the global maximum output. I think there's a book called The Goal, which I read way too long ago to remember all the details, but it the story about it is this gentleman working at a manufacturing plant of some sort, and the primary thesis of this book is that whatever system it is, anytime if you optimize anything other than the place where you are most constrained, you actually don't impact the final output of the system. So as far as dealing with that sort of like buzzword bingo giant map no one can navigate, like, I don't keep up with it. I admittedly it is all but impossible. But when I have a very specific business problem driving me to look at a said problem, then I work backwards. Okay, what is in the space? How do we try to solve this problem? For instance, if we have a problem with data visualization, great. That's a nit. Like, we want to put dashboards in front of clients. Great. What's in the space? Well, how are they differentiated? What specifically were you trying to solve? I can narrow in on that business problem. If that's top of mind for our business partners, that's what we do. We don't necessarily go down to like this small thing on the side. It's really focused on what is the biggest problem for driving business value. Focus on that, and then everything else is noise.
Do you find though that, like, I touched on it a little bit earlier, do you find that you end up with too many tools, or are you looking for ones that you can already reuse? Because you did talk about that total cost of ownership. You don't have to retrain people to support the new usage of an existing tool that you already know how to use. Like, how much does that weigh in as well? Because, and like, how do you think about, are you adding a new tool every 3 weeks, and are you kicking out an old tool every 3 weeks, or like, how is that looking to you right now?
Yeah. Trying to remember where I heard this idea, but I'm sure someone will correct me at a later point, but the idea of innovation tokens, I really wish I could remember where I read this, but you know, in an organization, you have a certain number of times where people are willing to change and try new things. And if you do it too often, you do it too frequently, you run a lot of risk, you get a lot of burnout, people just aren't sure what to follow, nothing feels stable. It's just hard to manage. And I might be butchering the original intent of the person who said that, but that's the way I think about it, is there are only so many shots we get at changing things. Now, we've actually reviewed vendors where, for specific spaces where we had overlap between two tools, and, you know, that we had an existing kind of tool that was available and did enough of the job. This new one we thought was better, but ultimately, because of that overlap, we decided not to go with that next choice because that existing condition of, hey, we have this existing tool, it does 80% of what we need. Like we can live without the last 20%. We don't need to add another few hundred thousand dollar contract on top of our P&L. And that was fine, a reasonable outcome because we had those conversations and we looked at the space in a very deliberate manner, like we've described so far. But to your point, if you just went with the wind and every time you get a new call from a SaaS vendor and just bought everything you ran across, you would have so many tools and so much bloat, arguably, that you don't really know where does it end. Like there's, especially as vendors try to artificially like segment their own pieces of market to differentiate themselves. Because they want to be differentiated, because if they're not differentiated, they have to compete on economics. If you are two tools, you do the exact same thing, you are going to compete on price, and they don't want to do that. So that is why we see the splintering, because if they're not splintered, it's a race to the bottom in terms of price.
When you think, I mean, this is going to be a somewhat obnoxiously difficult question to answer, but like just give it a little bit of a go if you can. When you think about bringing on a new tool, what percent of your total cost of ownership do you think about from integration cost with other tools, right? Like, is it that ends up, is it because you haven't had your Cambrian explosion that you're not trying to integrate everything with everything else and that you're not, it's not as big of a deal, but that's kind of a long-term decision or how do you think about that being a big challenge when you're bringing on a new tool?
So I think you're right to call out the integration cost, because integration costs work in both directions in terms of setting something up and tearing something out. So the way that, and I think we kind of fell into this rather than being so intentional, but now that I've like observed it a few times, I'm trying to be more deliberate, is really borrowing from the microservices world and thinking about anti-corruption layers and thinking about kind of limiting the surface area that any one system interacts with another. You know, for instance, we use Slack as our primary internal communications. We actually like integrate systems like through Slack. So it's like a Slack message shows up and then something else picks it up rather than integrating API to API. So that way, if we replace vendor X, it is very simple. It is again, just a Slack message, something that is common between the two, and it requires less lift to do it. Is it, does it make every engineer happy that they didn't get to write the code to like integrate those two things? And we're using like, some sort of like, if this, then that equivalent to move stuff between systems. No, they don't love that. But in terms of keeping our kind of data platform interoperable, keeping things, you know, lowering those switching costs, thinking about how we limit the amount of exposure entanglement that we bring when we bring in new tools, I think is really important. Because again, back to our earlier discussion, we get new evidence all the time. There are new things coming on the market. There are new things that solve problems. Economics change, needs change. Knowledge has a half-life. Decisions have a half-life. At some point, the decision you made will not be the right decision. You'll want to do something else. So like being willing to preserve some of that optionality, I think is important. There is a place where it like goes too far and you're like trying to build, like if you try to build, wrappers around everybody's APIs and you're maintaining those wrappers and you're like losing out on some of the functionality to like keep yourself insulated, like there can be there's a cost associated with that. But I think in general, thinking about it in terms of integration costs, switching costs, what would it take, asking the question, what would it take to remove this tool from our system? And if the answer is it's really, really expensive, well, then you're either pot committed, you're very much ingrained in what they're doing, or you need to start mitigating that risk.
To me, that's where I also push back a little bit on people trying to say you can't have any dependency on anything. with like the, because I think it can go way too far the other way. Exactly what you said. You want to set yourself up to not be in a bad economic situation. But there's also people that are like, I can't leverage any cloud service from any, you know, AWS or GCP or Azure or whatever, because I want to be able to run them on every single one exactly the same. And it's like, then you're not, you're spending so much time building your own, you know, S3 or building your own whatever, like you're spending so much time on that. So there is exactly that cost benefit of,
yeah, there's pragmatic. A cost to the optionality. There's a cost to that optionality. If you want to have the ability to move to any cloud provider, you're missing out on the tools that that might be built on any one of the three. So there are some decisions that we have tended to, like, we have made, you know, make a decision to be on a particular cloud provider. That's not a decision we're readily going to undo. That's not something we're going to be able to undo tomorrow. And that's a decision that when we made it on a multi-year time horizon. Other things like, you know, BI tools or any other specific SaaS data tool, like those are on shorter time horizons. And those are things like where we're more willing to change, but things like what cloud service we're on, like trying to preserve the optionality there is very expensive. And something that we've like decided we're not going to try to do. We're just going to lean into an ecosystem and just, you know, deal with that. Well, in that case, because we actually believe that that there's incentive for competition there. These cloud providers are competing against each other in a lot of ways, and we don't think they're going to be rent seeking as they could be, because there are multiple providers that we could conceivably switch. Because let's say they do 10x their price and their vendors don't. Well, that's a lot of incentive to make the effort. Yeah. That's a lot of incentive to like make that change, and you're going to be able to make that business case. But I think that's a lower probability event than I think we put that as like a, I would put that as a lower probability event. So I think that's why we're willing to more commit to a single cloud provider.
It's an economic decision, right? There's risk reward there, and you think the risk is low. So, and the reward of building in all of those extra things, you know, it's low and the cost is very high. So yeah. Like, why would you do? Yeah.
Yeah. And, exactly. And if the evidence shows up that I'm wrong, which, you know, I'm wrong multiple times a day, this could be one of them. Like it happens, then you adjust. It's not the end of the world. You just like, you made that assumption up front. It was very explicit in that decision. And if those assumptions change, our belief should change. And like, I think a healthy organization understands that. And as long as you are aware of what that cost benefit trade-off is and what your assumptions are around the potential benefit and potential risks, I think it's a healthy way to kind of make technology decisions.
Yeah, I feel for the people who aren't in that healthy kind of organization that has that approach. Well, Brandon, we've talked about a whole bunch of different things, but is there anything that we didn't cover that you really wanted to, or any way you'd want to kind of wrap up the episode in general?
No, I think we covered, I appreciate the conversation. We covered everything I would want to talk about in terms of vendor selection. And I hope folks can feel a little more confident making decisions in uncertainty and ultimately, like, I think importantly, revising their beliefs over time, because that, I think that's the most important part, is being willing to change your mind.
I think it's having empathy for your past and having empathy for others in the past too, right? Like, people are making decisions based on criteria and all of that. So, well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that would love to follow up with you. Where's the best place to do that? Is there anything specific you want people following up about?
LinkedIn's the best place to get a hold of me. And would be happy to have conversations about what we talked about today, navigating, you know, technology decisions. It's always an opportunity for me to learn, to understand like what other challenges people are facing. Cause back to that, giant ecosystem, like, I'm not looking at every part of the ecosystem. I don't really know what, you know, is going on in random sector X of the map there, but love to talk to folks and hear what they're learning and, you know, and help people kind of through that decision, you know, that technology decision journey.
Yeah, I think those conversations help both sides a lot. So I like setting those up as well. But well, Brandon, this has been so great. Thank you so much for the time. And thank you as well, everyone out there, for listening.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Brandon Beidel, Director of Product at Red Ventures. You can find a link to his LinkedIn in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.